Hello, and welcome to Around the Medieval Table, a podcast dedicated to examining the significance of food and mealtime in medieval European lives. Today we are considering how women interacted with medieval mealtime rituals in 15th century England. Our podcast begins with an imaginative overview of mealtime rituals, which our podcast will use as a case study. Mealtimes offer a window into secular and religious lives, particularly the lives of women. In 15th century England, two notable examples exist of how women used the beliefs about food and the social practices of mealtimes to develop a more public role in their communities. We will now consider two scenes from the dining table in mid-15th century England. The social context surrounding these meals was generally framed by a century of economic development in England. Cloth and wool industries were growing in importance. England remained a predominantly agrarian society, but urban centers such as London, Halifax, and Suffolk began to grow. The 15th century witnessed a string of monarchs, beginning with Henry IV and culminating with the rule of Henry VII. But generally, this period did not witness extreme levels of social unrest, and this allowed for the economic and social life in England to develop greatly during this period. The first scene we come to is in 1413, with details of mealtime rituals depicted here compiled from Fiona Swaby's research on the household books of Alice de Brenne. In a small village in Suffolk named Acton, during the New Year's feast of 1413, Alice de Brenne busied herself preparing for 300 guests to join her household to dine. On the menu would have been 2-pound loaves of bread and pints of ale and wine to drink. Meat, game birds, fresh fish, dried fish, smoked fish, and shellfish would likely all have been served. Local dairy produce would also have been present. This would have been a more unusual day for Alice. Yet her abundant hospitality meant not a single day of the year passed without her serving to meals to both guests and members of her household. This ultimately resulted in her serving 16,500 meals between Michaelmas of 1412 and Michaelmas of 1413. Let's imagine this New Year's Day. There is a celebratory atmosphere around the dinner table. You can imagine the noise of guests conversing. Guests would have likely been from a diversity of backgrounds, such as eminent men and their families, political figures such as bailiffs. Perhaps religious visitors and local laborers were in the area and attended the New Year's festivities. Still, this guest list would have been carefully curated by Alice. The circumstances of this meal are therefore slightly unusual, as it provided an opportunity for the community of Acton and outside visitors to share in quite a large and festive experience. And at the helm of this experience was Alice. Alice was born around 1360, likely at Acton Manor, to a family involved with the politics and royal court. She was married to Sir Guy Brian around 1375, and together they had two daughters. After his death, 11 years later, she never remarried, and around 1391, she took up the practice of farming her estates in the Essex and Suffolk region. She died just over the age of 75, around the year 1435, and was buried in Acton. During her time caring for her estates and serving meals to her household and guests, Alice kept detailed notes in her household book. Around 65% of the household expenditure was spent on food and drinks, though this number decreases to 40% when accounting for the home produce on the estate. When guests dined at the estate, they were all treated to the same fare. Similarly, Alice paid little mind to separating the social classes. The most notable difference was where people were seated, as more honored guests would be seated at the high table with Alice, and less notable guests would be seated lower down. While place was an important factor in how status was conveyed at mealtimes, people from different economic and social backgrounds were still able to come together and participate in mealtimes together. The way guests interacted with their space at mealtime rituals can also be seen in other examples of meals from later in the 15th century. Where one was placed at a table was often a silent way of conveying status and relating oneself to the community they were dining within. The social significance of these mealtime rituals was something women could take advantage of to safely relay a message about how they viewed themselves and their role in the world. One woman who used this system to convey a message about herself was Marjorie Kemp. Marjorie Kemp was born around 1373 in King's Lynn, Norfolk, into a well-respected family. Her father, John Brunham, was involved with the politics of King's Lynn, holding office as a mayor and acting as an alderman, coroner, and justice of peace. Marjorie's reputation suffered slightly after her marriage to John Kemp circa 1393, as he struggled with debts and was not highly engaged with the politics or social life of their community. Marjorie was also a controversial local figure, as she began experiencing visions from God after the birth of her first child. These visions motivated Marjorie to engage with more extreme expressions of faith, particularly beginning around the age of 40. These included fasting, abstaining from meat, convincing her husband to abstain from sex, and openly weeping as a means of expressing her beliefs. While Marjorie viewed herself as a mystic and did everything in her power to express this identity, she still risked being accused of being a heretic or lollard due to her extreme expressions of faith. It is here that mealtime rituals factor in to Marjorie's story. Mealtimes were communal events that allowed opportunities for women to engage with more public expressions of faith, which is something that Marjorie took advantage of. Let's take this time to imagine how Marjorie used the mealtime setting.
Satsang with Mooji.
instance, represented in chapter 29 of her book, Marjorie was traveling on pilgrimage in Jerusalem, openly weeping as she attended to Mount Zion and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Her weeping seemed to reach a new extreme on this pilgrimage, and she dictated that she was unable to stop as each site she visited reminded her of the Lord's Passion. Still, while in Jerusalem, she attended a meal with the Grey Friars, a Franciscan order, who took her in with them so that she did not have to eat alone. One can imagine how Marjorie's propensity for weeping may have made her an unwanted dinner guest. And indeed, there are instances when Marjorie ate alone due to how she expressed her faith. Yet, in this instance, she was accepted, joining into a religious community and sharing her experiences with the Grey Friars. While at the dinner table, one of the friars is quoted in the book as asking if that was the Englishwoman who, they had heard tell, spoke with God. Marjorie reflects on this experience as a sign that she was being honored by God and that he was spreading word of her good work. Of course, when analyzing how food and meals were represented in the book of Marjorie Kemp, one has to consider that these mealtime representations were carefully constructed and designed to convey a particular image of Marjorie as a religious figure. Still, the fact remains that mealtime rituals were symbolic, and Marjorie capitalized off this in her dictations. In the instance of the meal with the Grey Friars, Marjorie demonstrates to readers that her reputation had reached the Holy Land. She had been accepted into this community of Franciscans by participating in a meal with them. There are many ways Marjorie used mealtime rituals to express her faith. For Marjorie, food was spiritually nourishing, and both feasting and fasting allowed her to form a relationship with God. Marjorie often turned to food for physical and spiritual faith, stating early in the book of Marjorie Kemp that after her first vision, she, quote, took food and drink as her bodily strength would allow her, end quote. In other instances, she used the opportunity of meals to speak openly about her beliefs. In the book of Marjorie Kemp, Marjorie faces accusations of speaking the gospel and disobeying St. Paul's teachings that no woman should preach. Yet here, the setting of mealtime is protective. She argues that she is simply speaking at dinner, stating, quote, I use but communication and good words, and that will do while I live. Historian Juan He Park interprets this episode as showing that, quote, Marjorie's communication and good words are acceptable as long as they are not done in places like the pulpit, a public setting reserved only for the select few with the authority to step into it. But Marjorie does not need to go on a pulpit to spread her thoughts and promote her sanctity. Mealtimes with friends and enemies work just as well, where Marjorie conveys her inner conversation with Christ with her own words, or with silence and lowly position that speak just as loudly as her words. End quote. Therefore, mealtimes allowed women like Marjorie and Alice to form relationships with those they dined with. And both women took advantage of mealtime rituals to build community and create a social reputation for themselves. Thank you. The second section of this podcast will analyze these two case studies and consider the historiographic discussion on this topic. To begin this section, I felt it would be important to define public versus private lives in the context of these mealtime rituals. The private sphere is generally seen as family life, taking place in the space of the household. It is usually thought that women engaged with more private spheres as a space of the household, which women from many backgrounds were delegated to managing, is generally considered a private space. Privacy also reflects the inner lives of women, with the internal thoughts of women restricted to private conversations. As a result, many intimate details of medieval women's lives were not recorded. Public lives are viewed as the realm of public conversation and debate, an area seen as dominated by men and taking place outside of areas like the more private household. Historian Hwan Hee Park states that mealtimes are public scenes because the table is open to outsiders, and the sitters all put their behaviors on display in front of others. Despite this public nature, it is not a pulpit, and conversation at the dinner table cannot be considered to challenge any clerical authority. The relationship between public and private rituals in household records from Alice de Brin and the dictations from Marjorie Kemp demonstrate how important the setting and practices of mealtime rituals were for the social lives of women in medieval England. Alice enjoyed hosting meals for her personal friends, and historian Christina Mazzoni states that for Marjorie, quote, "food is what she repeatedly shared with her friends, creating relationships, celebrating life," end quote. In other ways, the public nature of mealtimes allowed women to engage with social, political, or religious goals. In her analysis of Alice's meals, historian Fiona Swaby states that in the household books, often the guest list suggests that a business meeting was in progress. The invitations to various churchmen can be viewed as connected not only with religious observance and social obligation, but also in the wider aspect of involvement with the outside world, beyond the narrow confines of the manor and small community of farmers. The dissemination of information was an important feature of their visits. In turn, Marjorie also used mealtime rituals to present herself as a mystic, using place settings, speeches, and silences to present a carefully constructed social and religious image. It is here that I must note the difficulty of using a more unusual and constructed example of women's experiences, such as the book of Marjorie Kemp. It is an autobiographical account of one woman's journey through faith and must be analyzed as such. This requires a recognition of the fact that the stories in the book were dictated by Marjorie and were subject to her own desires about how she wanted her life and faith presented to readers. For example, mealtimes fostered a sense of community, and to be present at the table generally implied one was accepted into a community. Therefore, Marjorie could demonstrate her sanctity without fear of being labeled a heretic by representing herself as present within a larger community whose orthodoxy would not be challenged. Additionally, the scribe who transcribed the text may have influenced how Marjorie's story was recorded and the details that were included. Still, the mealtime rituals in the book provide insight into the religious and social significance of food and dining in medieval Europe. Historians such as Hwan Hee Park have argued that the way mealtimes were represented in the book of Marjorie Kemp was reflective of a broader Christian understanding about the communal significance of meals. The Last Supper and the Eucharist Communion demonstrate how mealtime rituals were significant events for the Christian faith, and Marjorie capitalized off these beliefs to depict her devotion in the stories she dictated. Additionally, both the book and the household books of Alice de Brin demonstrate how meals offered women a chance to engage with the public due to the invitation of guests, yet also maintain the private intimacy of the household. This public-private dichotomy allowed women to take a more engaged role in speaking to guests and sharing their opinions in a more public venue. With the significance of Alice and Marjorie established, we can now turn to a discussion of the historiography. This section asks the question of how food can help us understand the social lives of women in medieval Europe. One of the most notable contributions to this topic is by historian Carolyn Walker Bynum. Her well-known contribution to medieval women's history is the monograph Holy Fast and Holy Feast. In this book, Bynum focuses on the religious significance of food for medieval women. This book generally focused on how women related themselves to food and religion through the taking of the Eucharist. The central theme of the text has been summarized with the argument that food was significant for the medieval mindset as a way to be united with God through the consumption of the Eucharist. Bynum offers insight into the gendered nature of fasting and feasting, considering how accounts of visions by religious women often featured themes of food or the Eucharist, and certainly these themes of food were more present for women's visions compared to the religious visions of men. Relevant to this podcast is the way Bynum examines the life of Marjorie of Kemp. She states that the early 15th century laywoman Marjorie Kemp, upon Christ's advice, manipulated her husband into accepting continence by offering to give up public fasts with which she was embarrassing him before the neighbors. Here, Bynum demonstrates how food provided Marjorie with power over her life. Here it acted as a bargaining chip for her to gain control over another aspect of her life. Bynum considers how women like Marjorie used food as a means of controlling circumstance. She argues that voluntary starvation, charitable food distribution, and Eucharistic devotion were all used by women to control their religious and social situations effectively and directly. Some women, such as Rita of Cassia, used food practices to tame the misbehavior of their husbands. Along with Marjorie, Mary of Oyne and Catherine of Genoa influenced their husbands to live lives of chastity and charity as they agreed to not embarrass their husbands with fasting rituals. Some women may also have fasted to protest being delegated to unfavorable household tasks. And others, like Dorothy of Montau, made rudimentary mistakes with their cooking in order to avoid preparing meals for their families. Throughout this analysis of how women used food to control their lives, Bynum generally focuses on women's religious lives. Historian Karma Lockrey has similarly focused on analyzing Marjorie Kemp's life and her religious devotion. Lockrey somewhat neglects the significance of food in Marjorie's dictations, yet she does also focus on the importance of the Eucharist for women who used fasting to demonstrate their devotion. Lockrey engages with the work of Bynum, using the analysis in Holy Feast, Holy Fast to examine the life of Catherine of Siena, who was disgusted by food and exhibited severe fasting aside from her cravings for the Eucharist. Lockrey approaches this example with a focus on how the body is represented in the lives of women, as she considers how the representations of the Eucharist as the body of Christ inspire devotion in the lives of many women. Bynum and Lockrey's contributions to the historiography of medieval women and the importance of female religious and social lives is important. However, other historians have since examined the relationship between religious women and food in greater detail. One of these women that has received additional focus is evidently Marjorie Kemp. In the book of Marjorie Kemp, Marjorie demonstrates how she had a more complex relationship with food and faith. While Eucharistic devotion was one aspect of how Marjorie engaged with food, She also, at other points, demonstrates how feasting and dining at large mealtime events was an equally significant expression of her faith. Historian Christina Mazzoni states that Bynum neglects to consider the, quote, positive images of eating and food preparation present in the book of Marjorie Kemp, end quote. In general, Mazzoni considers the relationship Marjorie and other medieval women had with food from both a religious, social, and economic perspective. This contribution to the scholarship provides important insight into the various ways food and meals allowed women to gain control over their circumstances. While Bynum has emphasized religious circumstances, Mazzoni emphasizes economic circumstances. The social and familial views of women can also be examined by considering how women related to their food and meals. Historian Gabriella Piccini has written about the strong associations that many of us make between food, family, and home. This domestic view of food reflects the earlier discussion of the perception that food prepared and consumed in the household was a private matter. While Piccini does not focus on Marjorie's experiences, as Marjorie's reflections on food do not generally convey a domestic tone, Piccini's contributions to the scholarly debate demonstrate how women like Marjorie and Alice could use the private, domestic perception of consuming food to engage with public discussions and goals. I will now end the podcast with a final quote from Bynum that summarizes the importance of this topic and the overall importance of research on medieval women's history. Bynum states, "A deeper understanding of what the ideas and lives of medieval women really meant not only helps us explain why they were as they were, it also rescues them from oblivion and illuminates their humanity." Thank you for listening.